This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's the presidential comparison that just won't seem to go away.
Programs regularly scheduled for this time will not be seen today in order that we might bring you the following NBC News special report. Watergate. Senate hearings.
I think Donald Trump is deep into Watergate territory.
The whole echo of Watergate is very strong here.
What we saw this week was Donald Trump saying out loud what Richard Nixon used to say in private.
It didn't take long for people to point out that what they saw as similarities between Comey's ousting and the so-called Saturday Night Massacre during the Watergate scandal of Richard Nixon's presidency.
We're hearing this comparison a lot more lately after reports that President Trump asked FBI Director James Comey to drop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Then there's Mr. Trump's style, his disdain for the press, his talk of law and order, and so on. In this hour, we'll put that comparison to the historical test and consider what it might mean for the nation if that comparison held up. Joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Nicole Hemmer, a professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Professor Hemmer, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Also with us for the hour is author and journalist John Farrell. His most recent book is called Richard Nixon, The Life, and he joins us from WGBH in Boston. Hi, John.
Hello.
And also with us here in studio is Matthew Dalek, a political historian and a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. Professor Dalek, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
We welcome your questions and comments about the Trump-Nixon comparison, especially if you remember living through the Watergate scandal and can feel differences or similarities with what's going on today. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Matthew Dalek, let me start with you. How did we get to this point? What do you think was the moment at which the Trump-Nixon comparisons began?
Well, some made them, I think, even during the campaign in terms of Trump's style. But I think the most recent moment was the firing of James Comey, because it had echoes, shades of Nixon's decision to fire the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. And the idea that a president is using his awesome authority to try to squelch an investigation that potentially touches him and his close campaign aides. Now we have the release of this information about this memo that Comey apparently wrote, that Trump wanted him to end the investigation into Michael Flynn. Well, that also has an echo of Watergate, of attempts to so-called, you know, obstruct justice. We're not there yet. I mean, there's a lot. There's more we don't know than what we do know. But I think that the events of this week, and they have come very fast, have at least evoked some comparisons that you know, are not illegitimate.
John Farrell, where do you think that the Trump-Nixon comparison is the strongest, and where do you think it's the weakest?
Well, as late as yesterday, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I would have argued that all this could just be Trump being Trump. And then the disclosure that the president interceded with the FBI director in the midst of conversations about whether the FBI director was going to keep his job, about Mr. Flynn, and advised him to go easy on him. And then when the FBI director declined to do so, the FBI director was fired. That's now has become real Watergate Saturday Night Massacre territory. The dots are being connected. And for the first time in this saga, we have a glimpse of a potential impeachable offense.
Professor Hemmer, what about you? Where do you think the comparison is strongest and where do you think it's weakest?
Well, I think we can't go too far without mentioning the fact that Trump mentioned he might have tapes. And that, to me, I think triggered even more of these Trump-Nixon Watergate comparisons, this idea that you would tape a meeting and maybe inadvertently catch yourself committing a crime. And that seems, as somebody who works in the Nixon tapes, a pretty strong parallel as well. But I would say that I do caution against some of these Watergate comparisons because they so easily slot us into a narrative of an inevitable march toward impeachment, which I'm not sure is something that's going to happen. And also, I think that the comparisons that we've talked about so far, it does make it sound sort of like a poor man's Watergate, that you have a Saturday night massacre that isn't quite as extreme as the actual Saturday night massacre. And then you have what's been called a smoking gun memo that isn't anything like the smoking gun tape that comes out with Nixon. So it's partly because we're much earlier in the process here, but the comparisons are easy to make, but I don't think quite perfect fits.
Yeah, and it seems like a number of our listeners are also a little critical of that comparison. I. Dominguez Urban tweeted, "This cannot be another Watergate. Before Watergate, the public knew very little about the machinations behind political campaigns. We're much more cynical now." And Larry in upstate New York wrote, "The only difference is that we don't know how it ends. As Yogi Berra famously said, predictions are really tough, especially about the future." Very true. We'll get to more of your emails and thoughts in a moment, but let's back up. Since predictions are tough, let's start with the history. These two terms that we have to clarify, Watergate, first of all, what that refers to, because there is a generation coming up that didn't grow up with this scandal, and also the smoking gun. So, Professor Dalek, start with Watergate, Yes. The building in D.C. where the DNC headquarters. Remind us exactly what happened there.
Sure. Well, five men were caught committing a burglary, what was called a third-rate burglary, although they had taping devices on them, they had cash, they had photography equipment. And it turned out that they had connections to the committee to reelect the president, which was Nixon's 19th. And this was, of course, the Democratic National Committee offices of Larry O'Brien. It's still unclear exactly what the information they were looking for. There are various theories. But this began a series of inquiries. And, of course, it took many months. I mean, Nixon, in between the catching of the burglars and the impeachment, stirrings of impeachment, and then his resignation, he won re-election. He won a landslide, I think 49 of 50 states in 1972. So it really was a slow burn, much slower burn than what we're talking about today. And then the other sort of brief note of caution I'd mention is that virtually every scandal since Watergate in Washington has been compared to Watergate, right? It's had a gate attached to it. And none of those have lived up to Watergate, okay? So I don't think, you know, we should jump immediately to, and history doesn't repeat itself. But I also think it's fair to say that, you know, we are seeing at least some echoes of the kinds of crimes that Nixon committed.
It's also worth noting that as this was all going on, as you said, Nixon went on with his political life. He won a landslide re-election. While the charges were kind of percolating around the Watergate break-in and the scandal, President Nixon spoke during a press conference in Orlando, Florida, where he gave one of his all-time most famous quotes.
"I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got."
That was President Richard Nixon speaking in Orlando, Florida. I think the other aspect of this that people are kind of looking for, possibly in this memo from former FBI Director James Comey, is what we now call the smoking gun, the thing that just sent everything over the edge, and that was the beginning of the end. John Farrell, remind us what the smoking gun was in the Watergate scandal.
Yeah, in the spring of 1973, as the burglars came to trial, Judge John Sirica threatened them with long prison sentences unless they talked about who ordered them into the Watergate. And that caused the first cracks in the Watergate cover-up and caused John Dean and others to go to the local prosecutors and ask to cut a deal. It led to the Senate Watergate hearings, which everybody remembers everybody of that generation remembers taking up that entire summer, and John Dean testifying for hours about his involvement with the president and alleging that the president was involved in the cover-up. But at that point, it was John Dean's word against Richard Nixon's. And it wasn't until midway through that summer when all of a sudden the committee discovered that there were White House tapes, and the special prosecutor went after those tapes, that everything ratcheted up. And it came to that great moment in October, that historic moment in October that's called the Saturday Night Massacre, when rather than surrender the tapes, Nixon fired the special prosecutor. Now, the big difference today is that because Richard Nixon used his aides to pressure the FBI, he didn't do it personally, it took months, more than a year, for us to finally get that, what's called the smoking gun tape, in which Nixon is heard directing his aides to pressure the FBI. Now we've got, within 120 days, we've got the President of the United States in a memo by the FBI director saying, go slow on the investigation.
We're up against a break in just a moment, but one of the emails that we've gotten, Greg emailed us, during Watergate, America's relationship with the press was very different than it is today. In the early 70s, the country was still very much in the three TV channel Walter Cronkite mode. People believed the news much more readily than they do now. After Woodward and Bernstein, after the massive media pressure on the president, and after Nixon's resigning, the media felt itself emboldened and empowered as a major player and participant in how government functioned. It has never been the same since. I would like us to talk about the role of the press in all of this, especially considering how Trump and Nixon both felt about the American news media, as we continue discussing whether the comparison between President Nixon and President Trump is an apt one, and if so, what does that mean for the rest of us? We're speaking with John Farrell, the author of Richard Nixon, The Life, University of Virginia Professor Nicole Hemmer, and George Washington University Professor Matthew Dalek. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the comparison between Richard Nixon and Donald Trump with Nicole Hemmer of the University of Virginia's Miller Center, Matthew Dalek of George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, John Farrell, the author of Richard Nixon, The Life, and with you. Do you believe that there are whiffs of Watergate in the air, or is the comparison overblown? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. A number of you have already shared your thoughts on this comparison with us. Here is some of what you left in our inbox.
Hi, I'm Diana from Fort Lauderdale, and I did live through the Nixon years. I was a kid. I was 7, 8 years old. But I can remember my father especially yelling at the TV. He was an immigrant from the Middle East, and he used to compare Nixon to the dictators and tyrants that he had seen in Middle Eastern countries. He used to say, "This guy is a con man." And I feel that more and more these days, the stories of the lies and the deception that we've been subjected to just comes back so clearly. And I hear my father's voice all over again saying, "This guy is a con."
This is Mark from Whitsitt, North Carolina. The comparisons with Watergate is just wishful thinking by individuals who just can't get over the fact that Hillary Clinton lost and Donald Trump won.
My name is Craig. I'm from Ohio. Listen, Nixon was nothing like Trump. There's no comparison. The man is more transparent than anybody I've ever seen. Trump, I'm saying. Nixon hid everything that he did. I lived through that. I watched that. I watched what our government did.
Hey, Joshua, this is Beth from Old Lyme, Connecticut. The Trump administration is nothing like the Nixon administration. They broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. It was a little break-in. It was mischief. And everyone was so concerned about it. The Trump administration does impeachable offenses on a daily basis. This is like nothing I've ever seen before in my life in all of American history, even the Civil War. It's insane.
Well, thank you, Diana and Mark and Craig and Beth, for sharing your thoughts about the comparison. Nicole Hemmer, Professor Hemmer, I wonder what you think about the point Diana was making about just experiencing Watergate. What is your read on how the nation felt during Watergate, viscerally, compared to how we kind of feel viscerally today?
Well, I think that one of the points that a lot of people have made is that the pace is very different. Watergate was this sort of slowly unfolding crisis, and people do get drawn into it over impeachment summer as they're learning more and more about the tapes and the wrongdoing and all of this. And so there's kind of a slow build, and this is so much faster, right? The pace of this is incredibly quick and intense. And I also think that the nation is experiencing this differently because of Watergate. There had never been this kind of scandal that had rocked through the presidency before. And now we sort of have a common language or a common touchstone for thinking about what's happening in the Trump administration. And I think that that impacts how we respond, even on an emotional level, and both amps up the urgency of the moment, but also, I think, can for some people make it look so much worse than Watergate, because Watergate, again, just it took years to build, whereas this is happening in just days.
Lenny writes, during Watergate, I was in my early 20s and a newspaper reporter, as was the man who became my husband. We remember it vividly and in some ways are more appalled now. Nixon badly abused his office and power, but he also understood his office. Trump doesn't. And when Nixon saw the jig was up, he resigned. Would Trump? Finally, where are Republicans like Howard Baker and Lowell Wicker when we desperately need them again? Professor Dalek, I wonder what you make of the of that last part of Lenny's comment in terms of the way Congress fits into all this.
Well, this is a significant difference between then and now, because then, of course, the Democrats control Congress. But you also had a lot of Republicans who came on board in support of the impeachment inquiry, who ultimately went to Richard Nixon and said, the support for you is just not there. He would have almost certainly been impeached, and he may have lost in the Senate vote back then. Today, of course, we have a much more partisan and polarized Congress. And what it reminds me of a little bit is the Bill Clinton impeachment scandal, because Clinton won. He survived in office in part by losing. He lost that impeachment vote. He was impeached, but it was a pure party line vote. Not a single Democrat voted to impeach him. And that's how he survived. So there was support for censuring him, but not for impeaching him on a bipartisan basis. Today, often Republicans are more worried about getting a primary from their right. And one point, just if I could make, that I, you know, would encourage people to look at the upcoming special elections, because there are three special elections, Georgia, South Carolina, and Montana, in deep Republican conservative seats. If the Democrats are able to pick off one or two of these that are coming up in the weeks ahead, Republicans might become more concerned about the political fallout. It could change the political dynamic about holding Trump accountable.
I'd like to play a clip from the Watergate impeachment hearings from 1974. And John Farrell, I'd like to get your take on the other side of the clip in terms of the way that Congress viewed impeachment then and the more nascent rumblings of impeachment now. This is Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Jordan of Texas, who set the tone, basically, for the Watergate hearing with her powerful opening remarks on July 25th, 1974. Congresswoman Jordan was laying out how serious the accusations have to be to justify Congress focusing on impeachment.
It was Woodrow Wilson who said that nothing short of the grossest offenses against the plain law of the land will suffice to give them speed and effectiveness. Indignation so great as to overgrow party interest may secure a conviction, but nothing else can. Common sense would be revolted if we engaged upon this process for petty reasons. Congress has a lot to do. Appropriations, tax reform, health insurance, campaign finance reform, housing, environmental protection, energy sufficiency, mass transportation. Pettiness cannot be allowed to stand in the face of such overwhelming problems. So today we're not being petty. We're trying to be big, because the task we have before us is a big one.
That was Texas Congresswoman Barbara Jordan speaking at the Watergate hearing on July 25, 1974. Nothing short of the grossest offenses against the plain law of the land will suffice, she said, quoting Woodrow Wilson, and talked about doing this for petty reasons. John, I think part of the counterargument to even discussing this comparison is that the nation has a lot to do. There are, as Congresswoman Jordan enumerated, many big tasks before the nation right now. How did that dialogue compare then and now about whether Congress has better things to worry about?
Well, listening to Barbara Jordan, parenthetically, it just reminded me of what a fantastic representative she was and how the Watergate scandal did manage to give us some heroes and heroines, and she was certainly one of them. Amazing woman, and Washington misses her and her kind. But she's certainly right. At the time, the only example of impeachment was the disastrous impeachment of Andrew Johnson in the years after the Civil War. And before I wrote this biography of Nixon, I wrote a biography of Tip O'Neill, and Tip O'Neill was really frightened at the idea that they were even going to discuss impeachment of Richard Nixon, because it was a dirty word. It was something that Congress didn't touch to for a century. It had been taboo. It had been nowhere's land. Now all that has changed. Impeachment is much more whatever Congress expects it's going to be. There's been another impeachment, but the bottom line of our talk about our sort of loose talk about impeachment is that you need 67 votes in the United States Senate once the House impeaches to convict a U.S. president. And that's a reason why there's been no U.S. president who's ever been impeached and convicted. That's a big, big total to get to. And when friends say to me, well, we're on the road to impeachment, I caution them that with Republicans in controlling both the House and the Senate, even if they were to lose the House, under the worst cases imaginable, you can't imagine them losing the Senate, and it's very hard to see a bill of impeachment getting 67 votes in the Senate.
And that might speak to part of the point that you were making, Professor, about watching some of these elections coming up, and then also the midterm elections as well. Let me get to a few more comments from our listeners. Cecil lived through Watergate. He commented on our Facebook page, President Trump is completely within his rights to declassify whatever he wants on a whim, referring to the classified information that was given to Russia's foreign minister and ambassador, to declassify whatever he wants on a whim, regardless of how stupid it may be to do so, and he breaks no laws in doing so. There is no comparison. Lying to the American public is part of the job. He hasn't lied under oath. I don't know if lying to the American public is part of the job, but Professor Hemmer, I do kind of see Cecil's point in that same oration that Congresswoman Jordan made, she talked about how the founders did not believe that maladministration, merely being a bad president, was grounds enough to impeach. You have to have actually committed a crime against the American people. You can't impeach someone just because you don't like the job they do.
Right. And here's where the language is tricky, because crime against the American people isn't necessarily a legal standard. It's a political standard. And impeachment is a political process. I think that's what John was just getting to, is that you need to be able to wrangle those votes. And it's not about having a bill of indictment that a prosecutor can hold up in front of a judge on a set of legal standards. High crimes and misdemeanors, which are the grounds for impeachment, is an ill-defined category. And so if there are enough Americans and certainly enough people in Congress who believe that what the president has done has moved beyond maladministration, has harmed the national interest, and has resulted in a high crime or misdemeanor, then impeachment can go forward. But that's a political matter and not a legal one. And so while it's important to know whether the president has committed an actual legal offense or not, that's not necessarily the thing that's most dispositive for impeachment.
Elaine in Conway, Arkansas wrote, I vividly remember the Watergate scandal and the two summers I spent watching the hearings and the vote to impeach. The difference is back then our legislators had the spine to hold the president and his men accountable and deal with the situation. Michael emailed, after 4 years as president, Nixon's reelection campaign broke into the DNC headquarters, the Watergate break-in that we mentioned. This was done with Nixon's knowledge, so an illegal act was done with the president's knowledge. Nixon realized his next 4 years would be difficult, and he resigned. He was not impeached. President Trump has made missteps. As a political outsider, all are understandable. No laws have been broken. John Farrell, can we unpack Michael's email a little bit? How much did Richard Nixon know about the Watergate break-in?
Well, the famous comment was by Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, which was that Nixon did not order the Watergate break-in, but he caused it. He created a climate in his administration. He is caught on the tape specifically telling Haldeman that in general terms, he wants surveillance and bugging of his Democratic opponents. But there's no evidence that Richard Nixon was specifically informed that there was this team of burglars and that they had planned to break into and bug Senator Muskie. They had planned to break in and bug Senator McGovern and finally got caught in the act of breaking in and bugging the Democratic National headquarters. The question of whether or not this is a big deal, however, I think goes back to the fact that the whole Russia situation is based around another break-in of a different kind, but of Democratic headquarters and another threat to the integrity of American presidential election. In some ways, we're focusing just on what President Trump said to Director Comey, but the bigger picture behind all this is a major historical development of a foreign power using cyberspace to interfere in Americans selecting their president. That's a big deal.
For sure. And also the aspect of Nixon's resignation. I do want to get more into that, Professor Dalek, but here is that famous speech from August 8, 1974, when President Nixon addressed the nation from the Oval Office.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
That was President Richard Nixon delivering his resignation on August 8, 1974. Professor Dalek, in light of hearing that, what do you make of Michael's comment that Nixon realized his next 4 years would be difficult and he resigned?
Well, I would say that what I think he realized is that he was going to be impeached and most likely convicted in the Senate. And so while we can question whether or not the sentiments he expressed in that resignation speech were genuine, the political reality, and this gets to the point that Nicole and John were making as well, the political reality was such that his position, his staying in the Oval Office, was no longer viable. And, you know, something like 22 legislative items had been introduced in the House related to impeachment I believe it was after the Saturday Night Massacre. So, you know, this was the politics were not with him. And also, you know, one other point that I think is worth making, you know, Nixon and what we now know is that there was a deep pattern of abuse, and it involved the campaign, surveillance, dirty tricks, forging memos, break-ins, a talk of hush money, talk of break-ins of the Brookings Institution.
And firebombing Brookings.
Firebombing Brookings Institution. And I think more than a dozen of Nixon's aides, many of them were top aides, in fact. So his campaign manager and attorney general were indicted. Many of them actually went to jail. Right now, we're not even close to that level of abuse.
We're going to catch our breath for a second and continue our conversation with George Washington University Professor Matthew Dalek, journalist and author John Farrell, and Nicole Hemmer of the University of Virginia. Plenty more to talk about, including deep throat. Several of you have been asking about that, about the nature of politics today, and maybe about what would happen if Watergate took place today. What would be different? Think on that while you hear this. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program on severe weather. Right now, the central U.S. is dealing with major storms, hail, and tornadoes. This weather is a fact of life, as is the destruction it can bring. And this summer could be the first major test of the Federal Emergency Management Administration, or FEMA, under President Trump. We're looking for stories of people who have recovered from a natural disaster with aid from FEMA. How easy or hard was the federal government to deal with? Did you get enough aid to get you back on your feet? What worked? And what should the president focus on improving? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. What was your experience of recovering from a natural disaster with aid from FEMA? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and press option 2. You could also record yourself and email the audio file to 1a@wamu.org. We'll discuss the nation's disaster response and share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation about comparing Presidents Donald Trump and Richard Nixon. Melissa writes, if it had not been for deep throat, would we have ever known Watergate happened? The Trump White House is in such disarray with so many leaks, including Trump himself. We have seen this unfolding in real time in 140 characters. I guess we're lucky in that way. John, what do you think?
Well, I think if there was not a deep throat, that Watergate still would have come out. Woodard and Bernstein were very resourceful. Ben Bradley was very determined. They were going to stay on that story. And while Mark Felt, who was the deputy director of the FBI, gave them invaluable information, they had other sources as well. And what they did is, rather than convict Richard Nixon, is they kept the story alive through that landslide election and raised questions in Judge Sirica's mind, so that when the judge had the opportunity to sentence the burglars and compel them to say who ordered them to do what they did, he had that 6 months or 9 months of Washington Post reporting in the back of his mind, and he said that he recognized that the Post reporting kept that story alive. So without deep throat, I think that we probably still would have gotten there. It would have been more difficult. It might have taken longer.
It's interesting that you mentioned the media and the Washington Post, because there is an audio recording of President Nixon talking to his press secretary, Ron Ziegler, back in 1972, explaining exactly how he feels about the Post.
I want it clearly understood that from now on, ever, no reporter from the Washington Post is ever to be in the White House. Is that clear?
Absolutely.
Unless it's a press conference.
Yes, sir. Now, the briefings here, but
not a briefing. But never in the White House. No church service. Nothing that Mrs. Nixon does. You tell Connie, don't tell Mrs. Nixon, because she'll approve it. No reporter from the Washington Post is ever to be in the White House again, and no photographer either.
Mm-hmm.
No photographer. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
None ever to be in. Now that is a total order, and if necessary, I'll fire you. You understand?
I do understand.
Okay.
Yes,
all right.
Okay.
Well, we know how far that order went. That was President Nixon speaking in 1972 about how much he absolutely loved the Washington Post. Of course, Woodward and Bernstein survived, as did the Washington Post. And this year, Carl Bernstein spoke about President Trump's attitude toward the media earlier this year. Listen.
Trump's attacks on the American press as enemies of the American people are more treacherous than Richard Nixon's attacks on the press. Nixon's attacks on the press were largely in private. There's a history of what enemy of the people that phrase means, as used by dictators and authoritarians, including Stalin, including Hitler, and I'm not about to say anything about comparing Hitler and Trump, but it's a demagogue's statement. And we live in a time now when there is no civic consensus in this country, like there was at the time of Watergate, about acceptable presidential conduct. There was a consensus that Nixon had to leave office because he had breached that acceptable conduct. We have no such acceptable compact among Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals in this country today. So Trump is out there on his own leading a demagogic attack on the institutions of free democracy, including the press.
That's former Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein speaking on CNN. Professor Hemmer, I wonder what you make of this relationship between the media and the president. I think it kind of fuels the argument of conservatives who say the media is out to get the president to hear things like this. I mean, Carl Bernstein kind of basically said, I'm not going to compare Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump, but I mean, that just that doesn't sit well with a lot of conservatives. And I wonder if that's the kind of thing that helped feed Richard Nixon's image among conservatives even after he resigned.
Yeah, I mean, I think where the parallels between Trump and Nixon feel strongest to me is on this media side, because he does have a similar, Trump has a similar approach to Nixon, where he attacks the media, but he also cultivates them. So he's constantly reaching out to reporters and giving them stories. But also that, you know, the media today, just as they, journalists today, just as they were back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, were in this moment of real crisis. And for journalists in the early 1970s, Woodward and Bernstein gave them a way out of that crisis where they had been rethinking their values. They had miscovered the Vietnam War. And here was a chance to show that journalism could be valuable and useful to American society, that it had a civic role to play. And I do think that journalists today look to that example as something to replicate, right? That we can show that we can hold the powerful to account. And so I think that does shape this. And it does shape the way that conservatives understand this presidency, just as it did during Watergate. During Watergate, conservatives cleaved even closer to Richard Nixon, who they didn't actually like that much. But when this scandal started, they saw it as Democrats and the media trying to reverse the results of the 1972 election, trying to overthrow this new silent majority. And I think you see a lot of that today, that by focusing on the media as the wrongdoers here, that it actually draws conservatives closer to Trump, even though they can be somewhat skeptical of his policies. So I think we'll actually see them moving closer to the Trump administration as this scandal unfolds, rather than being driven apart, at least in the immediate term.
Our listeners have been expressing some mixed views about the role of the media in all of this. Austin tweets, I believe a lot of people have been looking for some sort of Trump gate since he was elected, and this just happens to be the best fit. Stephen in Loveland, Ohio, emailed, one thing the Trump administration and Watergate have in common is that it is the free press that is so critical in getting to the truth. Where would we be without the First Amendment? We're continuing our conversation about this comparison with John Farrell, the author of Richard Nixon, The Life, University of Virginia Professor Nicole Hemmer, and Professor Matthew Dalek of the George Washington University. Let's hear a few more of the messages you left about this comparison in our inbox.
Becky from Boca Raton, Florida. Yes, I lived through the Nixon administration with Watergate. And it's a little too soon to say that the Trump administration reminds me personally of Watergate. There was a lot of damage done. Now, maybe some things will come out, maybe they won't. I think that, you know, our country is based on you're innocent until proven guilty, and I think the media needs to realize that and tone it down.
Well, hi, my name is Ed. I'm calling from Accord, New York. And during the Watergate summer, I had the car radio glued to the news station. I was driving for a delivery service at the time. And basically, Watergate was about a single break-in. What we're seeing now is an across-the-board level of incompetence and flagrant violating of the rules that's actually putting the country in serious danger. Nixon, for all his faults, at least was competent. Trump is incompetent, a buffoon, and putting the country into serious danger and screwing up in just so many ways.
This is Sherry from Indiana. I remember Watergate. I was working. I thought it was a shame, but I think you're overblowing the Trump deal. I am a Trump supporter, and I really am discouraged that everything I hear on NPR is negative about Trump.
Well, thank you for your thoughts, Becky and Ed and Sherry. And I wonder if Sherry's comment about the amount of negative coverage about President Trump might also have a parallel to the Watergate era. I'm wondering, Professor Dalek, whether or not there were other media outlets, maybe lawmakers, who were worried about this steady drumbeat and looking like they're just beating up on the president for less democratic, less noble reasons.
Yeah, well, I think this idea is correct that a lot of conservatives and some Republicans, and I think Nixon actually, even as he was resigning, still had about 25% approval rating or somewhere in the 20s. So it wasn't as if his support had entirely collapsed. But yeah, I think that there is a sense that dates back decades that, you know, the so-called mainstream media has a deeply liberal bias and is out to get conservatives. And that, in part, has generated a whole host of conservative voices and antidotes to that in response. And Trump tapped into that quite effectively. You know, I think it was Trump's vice president, Spiro Agnew, who called the press the nattering nabobs of negativity.
Right.
And, you know, Trump has said a worse about the media, but I think that idea lives on, and Trump has really turned into an art form. But one other point that I want to make, which is, I think, an important difference between then and now, and it's sort of our historical memory of Watergate. So Watergate, as much of a crisis as it was, it's also seen in some ways as a moment of democratic triumph. Our institutions worked. Congress, the courts, and the media. They stepped in. There was an abuse of power on a bipartisan basis. They captured Barbara Jordan's sort of idea of now is a time to be big. Now, I think there's a lot of questioning about are our institutions up to the task. The media environment is fractured. Who knows what the courts will do? And Congress is deeply polarized.
Old friend tweets, "We felt the dirty tricks guys were an aberration back then. There was still a Republican Party with honorable members. Now is the age of Roger Stone's." It's funny, Roger Stone's rise was kind of he kind of dovetailed with the Watergate era, but I wonder about that idea, John Farrell, about the nature of Republican politics in the age of Richard Nixon and the age of Trump. Both of them kind of coincided, I think, with turning points in Republican politics.
Yeah, I used to work for the National Journal, and every year we would do a survey of voting in Congress. And we'd draw a line down the middle of the Senate and the House of Representatives and try to find out how many Democrats voted to the right of that line and how many Republicans voted to the left of that line. And back in the days of Watergate, even through the Reagan administration and into the Bush years, you would always have a dozen, 14, 15 Republicans voting to the left of center and an equal number of Democrats, Southern Democrats, conservative Democrats, voting to the right of center. The last few times that we did that, we found that there were zero Republicans voting to the left and zero Democrats voting to the right. And that's the kind of polarity that we have now. And one reason why you talk about those off-year special elections and then the upcoming Virginia and New Jersey elections in the fall and then finally the off-year elections in 2 years. I don't believe that, although there are signs, I must say that Congressman Chavez of Utah, which has never really loved President Trump, has acted aggressively for his House Oversight Committee. So there are signs that the Republican Party mostly is sticking by their guy, and I don't think that we're going to see that kind of crumbling, those kinds of Lowell Weickers or Howard Bakers stepping out into the limelight until after they've suffered some reversals at the polls.
We're low on time, but I did want to get to one other comparison between Trump and Nixon. Andrew emailed us, "I'm not an apologist for Trump, but you can't compare the loose lips and bravado of Trump with the criminal scheming of Watergate and the Shakespearean flawed Nixon. Perhaps those flaws never really came out into the public sphere until 3 years after President Nixon kind of retreated into silence, resigned in disgrace, and gave an interview to British broadcaster David Frost, who famously coaxed an apology for Watergate out of Mr. Nixon.
I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest. Most of all, I let down an opportunity that I would have had for 2.5 more years to proceed on great projects and programs for building a lasting peace, which has been my dream, as you know, from our first interview in 1968, before I had any thought I might even win that year. I didn't tell you I didn't think I might win, but I wasn't sure. Yep, I let the American people down. And I have to carry that burden with me for the rest of my life.
That was Richard Nixon speaking to David Frost in 1977. Professor Hammer, we're low on time, but let me give you the last word. As a person, just as an individual dealing with controversy, how do you compare Richard Nixon? Granted, we have a longer record of him than we have of Donald Trump, but how do you compare him internally as a person to Donald Trump?
Well, they are quite different. I mean, I do think that both men had paranoia and insecurity issues, but Richard Nixon was someone who spent his life thinking deeply about government, who had an encyclopedic knowledge of the world, and did have this ability to be introspective. And that's not something we've yet seen with Donald Trump. It's not something that I expect that we will see with Donald Trump. And so I think that personality-wise, they are quite different, even if they are united in our minds by the scandal proneness of their administrations.
One more thought, and I'll let a listener have the last word, who maybe has a concern about the foundations behind this whole conversation. Natin writes, "The problem with the term Watergate is that it's so loaded that to suggest a comparison just plays into our biases. For those who vehemently distrust Trump, the comparison serves as a stamp of approval for their disdain. For those who vehemently distrust the media, the comparison serves as another example of a manufactured controversy." Well, this controversy is going to play out, and we'll have to keep an eye on it as it does. Matthew Dalek is a political historian and professor at the George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. Professor Dalek, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Nicole Hammer, professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Thank you, Professor Hammer.
Thank you.
And journalist and author John Farrell, his most recent book is Richard Nixon the Like. John, thank you.
You're welcome.
Remember to send in your stories about receiving aid from FEMA, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.